and they started telling everybody that we Walses lived in garbage and would stink up the pool water something awful. This was Ernie Goad's opportunity to take revenge for the Battle of Little Hobart Street. One of his friends came up with a phrase, health epidemic, and they were going on to the parents and lifeguards that we needed to be ejected to prevent an outbreak at the pool. Brian and I decided to leave. As we were walking away, Ernie Goad came up to the chain-link fence. "Go on home to the garbage dump," he shouted. His voice was shrill with triumph. "Go on now, and don't come back." A week later, with the heat still holding, I ran into Denisha Hewitt downtown. She had just come from the pool and had her wet hair pulled back under a scarf. "Brother, that water felt good," she said, drawing out the word good so it sounded like it had 15 O's in it. "Do you ever go swimming?" "They don't like us to go there," I said. Denisha nodded, even though I hadn't explained. Then she said, "Why don't you come swimming with us in the morning?" By us, I knew she meant the other black people. The pool was not segregated. Anyone could swim at any time, technically at least. But the fact was that all the black people swam in the morning when the pool was free, and all the white people swam in the afternoon when admission was 50 cents. No one had planned this arrangement, and no rules enforced it. That's just the way it was. I surely wanted to get back in that water, but I couldn't help but feel that if I took Denisha up on her offer, I'd be violating some sort of taboo. "Wouldn't anybody get mad?" I asked. "'Cause you're white?" she asked. "Your own kind might, but we won't. And your own kind won't be there." The next morning, I met Denisha in front of the pool entrance, my thrift shop one piece rolled inside my frayed gray towel. The white girl clerking the entrance booth gave me a surprised look when we passed through the gate, but she said nothing. The women's locker room was dark and smelled of pine sol, with cinder block walls and a wet cement floor. A soul tune was blasting out of an 8-track tape player, and all the black women packed between the peeling wooden benches were singing and dancing to the music. In the locker rooms I'd been in, the white women always seemed embarrassed by their nakedness and wrapped towels around their waist before slipping off their underpants. But most of the women here were buck naked. Some of them were skinny with angular hips and jutting collarbones. Others had big, pillowy behinds and huge, swinging breasts, and they were bumping their butts together and pushing their breasts up against each other as they danced. As soon as the women saw me, they stopped dancing. One of the naked ones came over and stood in front of me, her hands on her hips, and her breasts so close, I was terrified her nipples were going to touch me. Denisha explained that I was with her and that I was good people. The women looked at one another and shrugged. I was going on 13 and self-conscious, so I planned to slip my bathing suit on underneath my dress. But I worried this would only make me more conspicuous. So I took a deep breath and stepped out of my clothes. The scar on my ribs was about the size of my outstretched hand, and Denisha noticed it immediately. I explained that I had gotten it when I was 3, that I'd been in the hospital for 6 weeks getting skin grafts, and that was why I never wore a bikini. Denisha ran her fingers lightly over the scar tissue. "It ain't so bad," she said. "Hey, Nisha," one of the women shouted, "your white friend's got a red bush coming in." "What did you expect?" Denisha asked. "That's right," I said. "Collar got to match the cuffs." It was a line I'd heard Denisha use. She smiled at it, and all the women shrieked with laughter. One of the dancers bumped her hip up against me. I felt welcome enough to give her a saucy bump back. Denisha and I stayed in the pool all morning, splashing, practicing the backstroke and the butterfly. She flailed around in the water almost as much as I did. We stood on our hands and stuck our legs out of the water, did underwater twists, and played Marco Polo and chicken with the other kids. We climbed out to do cannonballs and watermelons off the side, making big geyser-like splashes intended to drench as many people sitting poolside as possible. By the time the free swim was over, my fingers and toes were completely wrinkled, and my eyes were red and stinging from the chlorine, which was so strong it wafted up from the pool in a vapor you could practically see. I'd never felt cleaner. That afternoon, I was alone in the house, still enjoying the itchy, dry feeling of my chlorine-scoured skin and the wobbly bone feeling you get from a lot of exercise, when I heard a knock on the door. The noise startled me. Almost no one ever visited us at 93 Little Hobart Street. I opened the door a few inches and peered out. A balding man carrying a file folder under his arm stood on the porch. Something about him said government, a species Dad had trained us to avoid. "Is the head of the household in?" he asked. "Who wants to know?" I said. The man smiled the way you do to sugarcoat bad news. "I'm with child welfare, and I'm looking for either Rex or Rosemary Walls," he said. "They're not here," I said. "How old are you?" he asked.
12.
"Can I come in?" I could see he was trying to peer behind me into the house. I pulled the door all the way closed except for a crack. "Mom and Dad wouldn't want me to let you in," I said. "Until they talk to their attorney," I added to impress him. "Just tell me what it is you're after, and I'll pass on the message." The man said that someone whose name he was not at liberty to disclose had called his office recommending an inquiry into conditions at 93 Little Hobart Street, where it was possible that dependent children might be living in a state of neglect. "No one's neglecting us," I said.
"You sure?"
"I'm sure, mister."
"Dad work?"
"Of course," I said. "He does odd jobs. And he's an entrepreneur. He's developing a technology to burn low-grade bituminous coal safely and efficiently."
"And your mother?"
"She's an artist," I said. "And a writer. And a teacher."
"Really?"
The man made a note on a pad.
"Where?"
"I don't think Mom and Dad would want me talking to you without them here," I said. "Come back when they're here. They'll answer your questions."
"Good," the man said. "I will come back. Tell them that."
He passed a business card through the crack in the doorway. I watched him make his way to the ground.
"Careful on those stairs now," I called. "We're in the process of building a new set."
After the man left, I was so furious that I ran up the hillside and started hurling rocks, big rocks that it took two hands to lift, into the garbage pit. Except for Irma, I had never hated anyone more than I hated that child welfare man. Not even Ernie Goad. At least when Ernie and his gang came around yelling that we were trash, we could fight them off with rocks. But if the child welfare man got it into his head that we were an unfit family, we'd have no way to drive him off. He'd launch an investigation and end up sending me and Brian and Lori and Maureen off to live with different families, even though we all got good grades and knew Morse code. I couldn't let that happen. No way I was going to lose Brian and Lori and Maureen. I wished we could do this skedaddle. For a long time, Brian, Lori, and I had assumed we would leave Welch sooner or later. Every couple of months, we'd ask Dad if we were going to move on. He'd sometimes talk about Australia or Alaska, but he never took any action. And when we asked Mom, she'd start singing some song about how her get-up-and-go had got up and went. Maybe coming back to Welch would kill the idea Dad used to have of himself as a man going places. The truth was, we were stuck. When Mom got home, I gave her the man's card and told her about his visit. I was still in a lather. I said that since neither she nor Dad could be bothered to work, and since she refused to leave Dad, the government was going to do the job of splitting up the family for her. I expected Mom to come back with one of her choice remarks, but she listened to my tirade in silence. Then she said she needed to consider her options. She sat down at her easel. She'd run out of canvases and had begun painting on plywood. So she picked up a piece of the wood, got out her palette, squeezed some paints onto it, and selected a brush. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm thinking," she said. Mom worked quickly, automatically, as if she knew exactly what it was she wanted to paint. A figure took shape in the middle of the board. It was a woman from the waist up, with her arms raised. Blue concentric circles appeared around the waist. The blue was water. Mom was painting a picture of a woman drowning in a stormy lake. When she was finished, she sat for a long time in silence, staring at the picture. "So what are we going to do?" I finally asked. "Jeanette, you're so focused, it's scary." "You didn't answer my question," I said. "I'll get a job, Jeanette," she snapped. She threw her paintbrush into the jar that held her turpentine and sat there, looking at the drowning woman. Qualified teachers were so scarce in McDowell County that two of the teachers I'd have at Welch High School had never been to college. Mom was able to land a job by the end of the week. We spent those days frantically trying to clean the house in anticipation of the return of the child welfare man. It was a hopeless task, given all the stacks of Mom's junk and the hole in the ceiling and the disgusting yellow bucket in the kitchen. However, for some reason, he never came back. Mom's job was teaching remedial reading in an elementary school in Davie, a coal mining camp 12 miles north of Welch. Since we still had no car, the school's principal arranged for Mom to get a ride with another teacher, Lucy Jo Rose, who had just graduated from Bluefield State College and who was so fat she could barely squeeze behind the steering wheel of her brown Dodge Dart. Lucy Jo, whom the principal had more or less ordered to perform this service, took an instant dislike to Mom. She refused to say much during the trip, instead playing Barbara Mandrell tapes and smoking filter tip cools the entire time. As soon as Mom got out of the car, Lucy Jo made a big show of spraying Mom's seat with Lysol. Mom, for her part, felt that Lucy Jo was woefully uninformed. When Mom mentioned Jackson Pollock once, Lucy Jo said that she had Polish blood and therefore did not appreciate Mom using derogatory names for Polish people. Mom had the same problems she'd had in Battle Mountain with organizing her paperwork and disciplining her students. At least one morning a week, she'd throw a tantrum and refuse to go to work, and Lori Bryan and I would have to get her collected and down to the street where Lucy Jo waited with a scowl, blue smoke chugging up from the dart's rusted through tailpipe. But at least we had money. While I'd been bringing in a little extra cash by babysitting, Brian was cutting other people's weeds, and Lori had a paper route. It didn't add up to much. Now Mom got paid about $700 a month, and the first time I saw her gray-green paycheck with its detachable stub and automated signatures, I thought our troubles were over. On paydays, Mom took us kids down to the big bank across from the courthouse to cash the check. After the cashier gave her the money, Mom went into a corner of the bank and stuffed it into a sock she'd safety pinned to her bra. Then we all scurried around to the power company and to the water authority and the landlord, paying off our bills with tens and twenties. The clerks averted their eyes as Mom fished the sock out of her bra, explaining to everyone within earshot that this was her way of making sure she was never pickpocketed. Mom also bought some electric heaters and a refrigerator on layaway, and we'd go to the appliance store and put down a few dollars every month, figuring they'd be ours by wintertime. Mom always had at least one extravagance on layaway, something we really didn't need, a tasseled silk throw or a cut crystal vase, because she said the surest way to feel rich was to invest in quality non-essentials. After that, we'd go to the grocery store at the bottom of the hill and stock up on staples such as beans and rice, powdered milk, and canned goods. Mom always bought the dented cans, even if they weren't marked down, because she said they needed to be loved, too. At home, we'd empty Mom's purse onto the sofa bed and count the remaining money.
There'd be hundreds of dollars, more than enough to cover our expenses until the end of the month, I thought. But month after month, the money would disappear before the next paycheck arrived. And once more, I'd find myself rooting in the garbage at school for food. Toward the end of 1 month that fall, Mom announced that we had only $1 for dinner. That was enough to buy 1 gallon of Neapolitan ice cream, which she said was not only delicious, but had lots of calcium and would be good for our bones. We brought the ice cream home, and Brian pulled apart the carton and cut the block into 5 even slices. I called dibs on first choice. Mom told us to savor it because we had no money for dinner the next night. "Mom, what happened to it all?" I asked as we ate our ice cream slices. "Gone, gone, gone," she said. "It's all gone." "But where?" Lori asked. "I've got a house full of kids and a husband who soaks up booze like a sponge," Mom said. "Making ends meet is harder than you think." It couldn't be that hard, I thought. Other moms did it. I tried quizzing her. Was she spending the money on herself? Was she giving it to Dad? Was Dad stealing it? Or did we go through it quickly? I couldn't get an answer. "Give us the money," I said. "We'll work out a budget and stick to it." "Easy for you to say," Mom replied. Lori and I did work out a budget, and we included a generous allowance for Mom to cover luxuries such as extra-large Hershey bars and cut crystal vases. If we kept to our budget, we believed, we could afford new clothes and shoes and coats and buy a ton of coal at the cheaper off-season price. Eventually, we could install insulation, run a water pipe into the house, and maybe even add a water heater. But Mom never turned the money over to us. So even though she had a steady job, we were living pretty much like we had before. I'd started seventh grade that fall, which meant attending Welch High School. It was a big school near the top of a hill looking down on the town, with a steep road leading up. Kids were bused in from way up in the hollows and from coal camps such as Davy and Hemp Hill that were too small to have their own high school. Some of the kids looked as poor as me, with their home-cut hair and holes in the toes of their shoes. I found it a lot easier to fit in than at Welch Elementary. Denisha Hewitt was there, too. That summer morning I'd spent swimming with Denisha at the public pool was the happiest time I'd had in Welch. But she never invited me back. And even though it was a public pool, I didn't feel I could go to the free swim unless I had an invitation from her. I saw her again only when school started, and neither of us ever mentioned that day at the pool. I guess we both knew that, given the way people in Welch thought about mixing, it would be too weird for us to try to be close friends. During lunch, Denisha hung out with the other black kids. But we had a study hall together, and passed notes to each other there. By the time she got to Welch High, Denisha had changed. The spark had gone out of her. She started drinking malt ale during school. She'd fill a soda can with Mad Dog 2020 and carry it right into class. I tried to find out what was wrong, but all I could pry from her was that her mother's new boyfriend had moved in with him, and the fit was a little tight. One day, just before Christmas, Denisha passed me a note in study hall, asking for girls' names that began with D. I wrote down as many as I could think of. Diane, Donna, Dora, Dreema, Deandra, and then wrote, "Why?" She passed a note back saying, "I think I'm pregnant." After Christmas, Denisha did not return to school. When a month had gone by, I walked around the mountain to her house and knocked on the door. A man opened it and stared at me. He had skin like an iron skillet and nicotine yellow eyes. He left the storm door shut, so I had to speak through the screen. "Is Denisha home?" I asked. "Why do you want to know?"
"I want to see her."
"She don't want to see you," he said and shut the door. I saw Denisha around town once or twice after that, and we waved but never spoke again. Later, we all learned she'd been arrested for stabbing her mother's boyfriend to death.
The other girls talked endlessly among themselves about who still had their cherry and how far they would let their boyfriends go. The world seemed divided into girls with boyfriends and girls without them. It was the distinction that mattered the most, practically the only one that did matter. I knew that boys were dangerous. They'd say they loved you, but they were always after something. Even though I didn't trust boys, I sure did wish one would show some interest in me. Kenny Hall, the old guy down the street, was still pining away from me, didn't count. If any boy was interested in me, I wondered if I'd have the wherewithal to tell him, when he tried to go too far, that I was not that kind of girl. But the truth was, I didn't need to worry much about fending off advances, seeing how, as Ernie Goad told me on every available occasion, I was pork chop ugly. And by that, he meant so ugly that if I wanted a dog to play with me, I'd have to tie a pork chop around my neck. I had what Mom called distinctive looks. That was one way of putting it. I was nearly 6 feet tall, pale as a frog's underbelly, and had bright red hair. My elbows were like flying wedges and my knees like tea saucers. But my most prominent feature, my worst, was my teeth. They weren't rotten or crooked. In fact, they were big, healthy things. But they stuck straight out. The top row thrust forward so enthusiastically that I had trouble closing my mouth completely, and I was always stretching my upper lip to try to cover them. When I laughed, I put my hand over my mouth. Lori told me I had an exaggerated view of how bad my teeth looked. "They're just a little bucked," she'd say. "They have a certain Pippi Longstocking-ish charm." Mom told me my overbite gave my face character. Brian said they'd come in handy if I ever needed to eat an apple through the knothole in a fence. What I needed, I knew, was braces. Every time I looked in the mirror, I longed for what the other kids called a barbed wire mouth. Mom and Dad had no money for braces, of course. None of us kids had ever even been to the dentist. But since I'd been babysitting and doing other kids' homework for cash, I resolved to save up until I could afford braces myself. I had no idea how much they cost. So I approached the only girl in my class who wore braces, and after complimenting her orthodontia, casually asked how much it had set her folks back. When she said $1,200, I almost fell over. I was getting $1 an hour to babysit. I usually worked 5 or 6 hours a week, which meant that if I saved every penny I earned, it would take about 4 years to raise the money. I decided to make my own braces. I went to the library and asked for a book on orthodontia. The librarian looked at me kind of funny and said she didn't have one, so I realized I'd have to figure things out as I went along. The process involved some experimentation and several false starts. At first, I simply used a rubber band. Before going to bed, I would stretch it all the way around the entire set of my upper teeth. The rubber band was small but thick and had a good, tight fit. But it pressed uncomfortably on my tongue, and sometimes it would pop off during the night, and I'd wake up choking on it. Usually, however, it stayed on all night, and in the morning, my gums would be sore from the pressure on my teeth. That seemed like a promising sign, but I began to worry that instead of pushing my front teeth in, the rubber band might be pulling my back teeth forward. So I got some larger rubber bands and wore them around my whole head, pressing against my front teeth. The problem with this technique was that the rubber bands were tight. They had to be to work. So I'd wake up with headaches and deep red marks where the rubber bands had dug into the sides of my face. I needed more advanced technology. I bent a metal coat hanger into a horseshoe shape to fit the back of my head. Then I curled the two ends outward, so when the coat hanger was around my head, the ends angled away from my face and formed hooks to hold the rubber band in place. When I tried it on, the coat hanger dug into the back of my skull, so I used a Kotex sanitary napkin for padding.
The contraption worked perfectly, except that I had to sleep flat on my back, which I always had trouble doing, especially when it was cold. I liked to snuggle down into the blankets. Also, the rubber band still popped off in the middle of the night. Another drawback was that the device took a lot of time to put on properly. I'd wait until it was dark so no one else would see it. One night, I was lying in my bunk, wearing my elaborate coat hanger braces, when the bedroom door opened. I could make out a dim figure in the darkness. "Who's there?" I called out. But because I had my braces on, it came out sounding like, "Poof there." "It's your old man," Dad answered. "What's with the mumbling?" He came over to my bunk, held up his Zippo and flicked it. A flame shot up. "What the Sam Hill's that on your head?" "My Bigfoot," I said.
"Your what?"
I took off the contraption and explained to Dad that because my front teeth stuck out so badly, I needed braces, but they cost $1,200. So I'd made my own. "Put them back on," Dad said. He studied my handiwork intently, then nodded. "Those braces are a goddamn feat of engineering genius," he said. "You take after your old man." He took my chin and pulled my mouth open. "And I think they're by God working." That year, I started working for the school newspaper, The Maroon Wave. I wanted to join some club or group or organization where I could feel I belonged, where people wouldn't move away if I sat down next to them. I was a good runner, and I thought of going out for the track team, but you had to pay for your uniform, and Mom said we couldn't afford it. You didn't have to buy a uniform or any musical instrument or pay any dues to work on the Wave. Miss Jeanette Bivens, one of the high school English teachers, was the Wave's faculty advisor. She was a quiet, precise woman who had been at Welch High School so long that she had also been Dad's English teacher. She was the first person in his life, he once told me, who'd showed any faith in him. She thought he was a talented writer and had encouraged him to submit a 24-line poem called Summer Storm to a statewide poetry competition. When it won first prize, one of Dad's other teachers wondered aloud if the son of two low-life alcoholics like Ted and Irma Walls could have written it himself. Dad was so insulted he walked out of school. It was Miss Bivens who convinced him to return and earn his diploma, telling him he had what it took to be somebody. Dad named me after her. Mom suggested the second N to make it more elegant and French. Miss Bivens told me that as far as she could remember, I was the only seventh grader who'd ever worked for the Wave. I started out as a proofreader. On winter evenings, instead of huddling around the stove at 93 Little Hobart Street, I'd go down to the warm, dry offices of the Welch Daily News, where the Maroon Wave was typeset, laid out, and printed. I loved the newsroom's purposeful atmosphere. Teletype machines clattered against the wall as spools of paper carrying news from around the world piled up on the floor. Banks of fluorescent lights hung down 18 inches above the slanted, glass-topped desks where men wearing green eye shades conferred over stacks of copy and photographs. I'd take the Wave galleys and sit at one of the desks, my back firm, a pencil behind my ear, studying the pages for typos. The years I'd spent helping Mom check spelling on her students' homework had given me a lot of practice for this line of work. I'd make corrections with a light blue felt marker that couldn't be picked up by the camera that photographed the pages for printing. The typesetters would retype the lines I'd corrected and print them out. I'd run the corrected lines through the hot wax machine that made the backside sticky, then cut out the lines with an X-Acto knife and fit them over the original lines. I tried to remain inconspicuous in the newsroom, but one of the typesetters, a crabbed, chain-smoking woman who always wore a hairnet, took a dislike to me. She thought I was dirty. When I walked by, she'd turn to the other typesetters and say loudly, "Y'all smell something funny?" Just like Lucy Jo Rose had done to Mom, She took to spraying disinfectant and air freshener in my general direction. Then she complained to the editor, Mr. Muckenfuss, that I might have head lice and could infect the entire staff. Mr. Muckenfuss conferred with Miss Bivens, and she told me that as long as I kept clean, she'd fight for me. That was when I started going back to Grandpa and Uncle Stanley's apartment for a weekly bath, though when I was there, I made sure to give Uncle Stanley a wide berth. Whenever I was at the Daily News, I watched the editors and reporters at work in the newsroom. They kept a police scanner on all the time, and when an accident or fire or crime was called in, an editor would send a reporter to find out what had happened. He'd come back a couple of hours later and type up a story, and it would appear in the next day's paper. This appealed to me mightily. Until then, when I thought of writers, what first came to mind was Mom, hunched over her typewriter, clattering away on her novels and plays and philosophies of life, and occasionally receiving a personalized rejection letter. But a newspaper reporter, instead of holing up in isolation, was in touch with the rest of the world. What the reporter wrote influenced what people thought about and talked about the next day. He knew what was really going on. I decided I wanted to be one of the people who knew what was really going on. When my work was done, I read the stories on the wire services. Because we never subscribed to newspapers or magazines, I'd never known what was going on in the world, except for the skewed version of events we got from Mom and Dad, in which every politician was a crook, every cop was a thug, and every criminal had been framed. I began to feel like I was getting the whole story for the first time, that I was being handed the missing pieces to the puzzle, and that the world was making a little more sense. At times, I felt like I was failing Maureen, like I wasn't keeping my promise that I'd protect her, the promise I'd made to her when I held her on the way home from the hospital after she'd been born. I couldn't get her what she needed most, hot baths, a warm bed, steaming bowls of cream a week before school in the morning. But I tried to do little things. When she turned 7 that year, I told Brian and Lori that she needed a special birthday celebration. We knew Mom and Dad wouldn't get her presents, so we saved for months, went to the Dollar General store, and bought her a toy set of kitchen appliances that were pretty realistic. The agitator in the washing machine twisted around, and the refrigerator had metal shelves inside. We figured when she was playing, she could at least pretend to have clean clothes and regular meals. "Tell me again about California," Maureen said after she opened the presents. Although she'd been born there, she couldn't remember it. She always loved hearing our stories about life in the California desert. So we told them to her again about how the sun shone all the time, and it was so warm that we ran around barefoot even in the dead of winter. About how we ate lettuce in the farm fields and picked carloads of green grapes and slept on blankets under the stars. We told her that she was blonde because she'd been born in a state where so much gold had been mined, and she had blue eyes the color of the ocean that washed onto California's beaches. "That's where I'm going to live when I grow up," Maureen said. Although she longed for California, the magical place of light and warmth, she seemed happier than the rest of us kids in Welch. She was a storybook beautiful girl, with long blonde hair and startling blue eyes. She spent so much time with the families of her friends that she often didn't seem like a member of our family. A lot of her friends were Pentecostals whose parents held that Mom and Dad were disgracefully irresponsible and took it upon themselves to save Maureen's soul. They took her up like a surrogate daughter and brought her with them to revival meetings and to snake handling services over in Jolo. Under their influence, Maureen developed a powerful religious streak. She got baptized more than once and was all the time coming home proclaiming that she'd been born again. She once insisted that the devil had taken the form of a hoop snake with its tail in its mouth and had rolled after her down the mountain, hissing that it would claim her soul. Brian told Mom we needed to keep Maureen away from those nutty Pentecostals, but Mom said we all came to religion in our individual ways, and we each needed to respect the religious practices of others, seeing as it was up to every human being to find his or her own way to heaven.
Mom could be as wise as a philosopher, but her moods were getting on my nerves. At times, she'd be happy for days on end, announcing that she had decided to think only positive thoughts, because if you think positive thoughts, then positive things will happen to you. But the positive thoughts would give way to negative thoughts, and the negative thoughts seemed to swoop into her mind the way a big flock of black crows takes over a landscape, sitting thick in the trees and on the fence rails and lawns, staring at you in ominous silence. When that happened, Mom would refuse to get out of bed, even when Lucy Jo showed up to drive her to school, honking impatiently. One morning toward the end of the school year, Mom had a complete meltdown. She was supposed to write up evaluations of her students' progress, but she'd spent every free minute painting, and now the deadline was on her, and the evaluations were unwritten. The remedial reading program was going to lose its funding, and the principal would be either furious or just plain disgusted. Mom couldn't bear to face the woman. Lucy Jo, who had been waiting for Mom in the dark, drove off without her, and Mom lay wrapped up in the blankets on the sofa bed, sobbing about how much she hated her life. Dad wasn't there, and neither was Maureen. Brian typically started doing an impersonation of Mom carrying on and sobbing, but no one was laughing, so he picked up his books and walked out of the house. Lori sat next to Mom on the bed, trying to console her. I just stood in the doorway with my arms crossed, staring at her. It was hard for me to believe that this woman, with her head under the blankets, feeling sorry for herself and boo-hooing like a 5-year-old, was my mother. Mom was 38. Not young, but not old either. In 25 years, I told myself, I'd be as old as she was now. I had no idea what my life would be like then, but as I gathered my school books and walked out the door, I swore to myself that it would never be like Mom's, that I would not be crying my eyes out in an unheated shack in some godforsaken holler. I walked down Little Hobart Street. It had rained the night before, and the only sound was the gurgle of the runoff pouring down the eroded gullies on the hillside. Thin streams of muddy water flowed across the road, seeping into my shoes and soaking my socks. The sole of my right shoe had come loose and flapped with each step. Lori caught up with me, and we walked for a while in silence. "Poor Mom," Lori finally said. "She's got it tough." "No tougher than the rest of us," I said. "Yes, she does," Lori said. "She's the one who's married to Dad." "That was her choice," I said. "She needs to be firmer, lay down the law for Dad instead of getting hysterical all the time. What Dad needs is a strong woman." "A caryatid wouldn't be strong enough for Dad." "What's that?" "Pillars shaped like women," Lori said. "The ones holding up Greek temples with their heads. I was looking at a picture of some the other day thinking, those women have the second toughest job in the world." I disagreed with Lori. I thought a strong woman would be able to manage Dad. What he needed was someone who was focused and determined. Someone who would set ultimatums and stick to them. I figured I was strong enough to keep Dad in line. When Mom told me I was so focused it was scary, I know she didn't mean it as a compliment, but I took it that way. My chance to prove that Dad could be managed came that summer once school was out. Mom had to spend 8 weeks up in Charleston, taking college courses to renew her teaching certificate. Or so she said. I wondered if she was looking for a way to get away from us all for a while. Lori, because of her good grades and art portfolio, had been accepted into a government-sponsored summer camp for students with special aptitudes. That left me, at 13, the head of the household. Before Mom left, she gave me $200. That was plenty, she said, to buy food for Brian and Maureen and me for 2 months and pay the water and electricity bills. I did the math. It came out to $25 a week,
or a little over $350 a day. I worked up a budget and calculated that we could indeed squeak by if I made extra money babysitting. For the first week, everything went according to plan. I bought food and made meals for Brian, Maureen, and me. It had been almost a year since the welfare man had scared us into cleaning the house, and it was once again an unholy mess. Mom would have a fit if I had thrown anything out, but I spent hours straightening up and trying to organize the huge stacks of junk. Dad usually stayed out at night until we were in bed, and he'd be asleep when we got up and left in the morning. But one afternoon, about a week after Mom had gone to Charleston, he caught me alone in the house. "Hun, I need some money," he said. "For what?" "Beer and cigarettes." "I've got sort of a tight budget, Dad." "I don't need much, just $5. That was 2 days' worth of food. A half gallon of milk, a loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, 2 cans of Jack mackerel, a small bag of apples, and some popcorn. And Dad wasn't even doing me the honor of pretending he needed the money for something useful. He didn't argue or wheedle or cajole or ratchet the charm way up. He simply waited for me to fork over the cash, as if he knew I didn't have it in me to say no. And I didn't. I took out my green plastic change purse and pulled out a crumpled five and passed it over slowly. "You're a doll," Dad said, and gave me a kiss. I pulled my head back. Giving him that money pissed me off. I was mad at myself, but even madder at Dad. He knew I had a soft spot for him the way no one else in the family did, and he was taking advantage of it. I felt used. The girls at school always talked about how this or that guy was a user and how such and such a girl got used. And now I understood, from deep inside, the meaning of that word. When Dad asked me for another $5 a few days later, I gave it to him. It made me feel sick thinking how I was now $10 off budget. In a few more days, he asked for $20. $20? I couldn't believe Dad was pushing me this far. Why $20? "God damn it, since when do I have to explain myself to my children?" Dad asked. In the next breath, he told me that he'd borrowed a friend's car and needed to buy gas so he could drive to Gary for a business meeting. "I need money to make money. I'll pay you back." He looked at me, defying me to disbelieve him. "I've got bills piling up," I said. I heard my voice growing shrill, but I couldn't control it. "I've got kids to feed." "Don't you worry about food and bills," Dad said. "That's for me to worry about, okay?" I put my hand in my pocket. I didn't know if I was reaching for my money or trying to protect it. "Have I ever let you down?" Dad asked. I'd heard that question at least 200 times, and I'd always answered it the way I knew he wanted me to, because I thought it was my faith in Dad that kept him going all those years. I was about to tell him the truth for the first time, about to let him know that he'd let us all down plenty. But then I stopped. I couldn't do it. Dad, meanwhile, was saying he was not asking me for the money. He was telling me to give it to him. He needed it. Did I think he was a liar when he said he'd get it back to me? I gave him the $20. That Saturday, Dad told me that to pay me back, he had to earn the money first. He wanted me to accompany him on a business trip. He said I needed to wear something nice. He went through my dresses hanging from the pipe in the bedroom and picked out one with blue flowers that buttoned up the front. He had borrowed a car, an old pea-green Plymouth with a broken passenger side window, and we drove through the mountains to a nearby town, stopping at a roadside bar. The place was dark and hazy as a battlefield from the cigarette smoke. Neon signs for Pabst Blue Ribbon and Old Milwaukee glowed on the walls. Gaunt men with creased cheeks and women with dark red lipstick sat along the bar. A couple of guys wearing steel-toed boots played pool. Dad and I took seats at the bar. Dad ordered Buds for himself and me, even though I told him I wanted a Sprite. After a while, he got up to play pool, and no sooner had he left his stool than a man came over and sat on it. He had a black mustache that curved around the sides of his mouth and coal grime under his fingernails. He poured salt in his beer, which Dad said some guys did because they liked to make extra foam. "Name's Robbie," he said. "That your man there?" He gestured toward Dad. "I'm his daughter," I said. He took a lick of foam and started asking me about myself, leaning in close as he talked. "How old are you, girl?" "How old do you think?" I asked. "About 17. I smiled, putting my hand over my teeth. "Know how to dance?" he asked. I shook my head. "Sure you do," he said, and pulled me off the stool. I looked over at Dad, who grinned and waved. On the jukebox, Kitty Wells was singing about married men and honky-tonk angels. Robbie held me close, with his hand on the small of my back. We danced to a second song, and when we sat down again on the stools facing the pool table, our backs against the bar, he slid his arm behind me. That arm made me tense, but not entirely unhappy. No one had flirted with me since Billy Deal, unless you counted Kenny Hall. Still, I knew what Robbie was after. I was going to tell him I wasn't that sort of girl, but then I thought he would say I was getting ahead of myself. After all, the only thing he'd done was dance me slow and put his arm around me. I caught Dad's eye. I expected him to come barreling across the room and walk Robbie with a pull cue for getting fresh with his daughter. Instead, he hollered to Robbie, "Do something worthwhile with those damned hands of yours. Get over here and play me a game of pool." They ordered whiskeys and chalked their cues. Dad held back at first and lost some money to Robbie, then started upping the stakes and beating him. After every game, Robbie wanted to dance with me again. It went on that way for a couple of hours, with Robbie getting sloppy drunk, losing to Dad, and groping me when we danced or sat down at the bar between games. All Dad said to me was, "Keep your legs crossed, honey, and keep 'em crossed tight." After Dad had taken him for about $80, Robbie started muttering angrily to himself. He snapped down the cue chalk, sending up a puff of blue powder, and missed a final shot. He flung his cue on the table and announced he'd had enough and sat down next to me. His eyes were bleary. He kept saying he couldn't believe that old fart had beat him out of $80, as if he couldn't decide whether he was pissed off or impressed. Then he told me he lived in an apartment over the bar. He had a Roy Acuff record that wasn't on the jukebox, and he wanted us to go upstairs and listen to it. If all he wanted to do was dance some more and maybe kiss a little, I could handle that. But I had the feeling he thought he was entitled to something in return for losing so much money. "I'm not sure," I said. "Aw, come on," he said, and shouted at Dad. "I'm gonna take your girl upstairs." "Sure," Dad said. "Just don't do anything I wouldn't do." He pointed his pool cue at me. "Holler if you need me," he said, and winked at me, as if to say he knew I could take care of myself, that this was just a part of my job. So, with Dad's blessing, I went upstairs. Inside the apartment, we pushed through a curtain made from strands of beer can pool tabs linked together. Two men sat on a couch watching wrestling on television. When they saw me, they grinned wolfishly at Robbie, who put on the Roy Acuff record without turning down the television. He pressed me to him and started dancing again, but I knew this was not going in a direction I wanted, and I resisted him. His hands dropped down. He squeezed my bottom, pushed me onto the bed, and began kissing me. "All right," one of his friends said, and the other yelled, "Get it on!" "I'm not that kind of girl," I said, but he ignored me. When I tried rolling away, he pinned back my arms. Dad had said to holler if I needed him, but I didn't want to scream. I was so angry at Dad that I couldn't bear the idea of him rescuing me.
Robbie, meanwhile, was saying something about me being too bony to screw.
Yeah, most guys don't like me, I said. Besides being skinny, I got these scars.
Oh, sure, he said, but he paused.
I rolled off the bed, quickly unbuttoned my dress at the waist, and pulled it open to show him the scar on my right side. For all he knew, my entire torso was one giant mass of scar tissue. Robbie looked uncertainly at his friends. It was like seeing a gap in a fence.
I think I hear Dad calling, I said,
then made for the door.
In the car, Dad took out the money he'd won and counted out $40, which he passed to me.
We make a good team, he said.
I felt like throwing the money at him, but we kids needed it, so I put the bills in my purse. We hadn't scammed Robbie, but we'd worked him in a way that felt downright sleazy, and I'd ended up in a tight spot. If Robbie had been set up by Dad, so had I.
You upset about something, Mountain Goat?
For a moment, I considered not telling Dad. I was afraid there'd be bloodshed, since he was always going on about how he'd kill anyone who laid a finger on me. Then I decided I wanted to see the guy pummeled.
Dad, that creep attacked me while we were upstairs.
I'm sure he just pawed you some, Dad said as we pulled out of the parking lot. I knew you could handle yourself.
The road back to Welch was dark and empty. The wind whistled through the broken window on my side of the Plymouth. Dad lit a cigarette.
It was like that time I threw you into the sulfur spring to teach you to swim, he said. You might have been convinced that you were going to drown, but I knew you'd do just fine.
The next evening, Dad disappeared. After a couple of days, he wanted me to go out with him again to some bar, but I said no. Dad got ticked off and said that if I wasn't going to team up with him, the least I could do was take him some pool-shooting money. I found myself forking over a 20, and then another in a few days. Mom had told me to expect a check in early July for the lease on her Texas land. She also warned me that Dad would try to get his hands on it. Dad actually waited at the foot of the hill for the mailman and took it from him on the day it arrived. But when the mailman told me what had happened, I ran down Little Hobart Street and caught Dad before he got into town. I told him Mom had wanted me to hide the check until she returned. Let's hide it together, Dad said, and suggested we stash it in the 1933 World Book Encyclopedia Mom got free from the library, under currency. The next day, when I went to rehide the check, it was gone. Dad swore he had no idea what happened to it. I knew he was lying, but I also knew if I accused him, he'd deny it, and there'd be a loud yelling match that wouldn't do me any good. For the first time, I had a clear idea of what Mom was up against. Being a strong woman was harder than I had thought. Mom still had more than a month in Charleston. We were about to run out of grocery money, and my babysitting income wasn't making up the difference. I had seen a help wanted sign in the window of a jewelry store on McDowell Street called Becker's Jewel Box. I put on a lot of makeup, my best dress, it was purple with tiny white dots and a sash that tied in the back, and a pair of Mom's high heels, since we wore the same size. Then I walked around the mountain to apply for the job. I pushed open the door, jangling the bells overhead. Becker's Jewel Box was a fancy store, the kind of place I'd never had the occasion to go into, with a humming air conditioner and buzzing fluorescent lights. Locked glass display cases held rings and necklaces and brooches, and a few guitars and banjos hung on the pine board paneled walls to diversify the merchandise. Mr. Becker was leaning on the counter with his fingers interlocked. He had a stomach so big that his thin black belt reminded me of the equator circling the globe. I was afraid that Mr. Becker wouldn't give me the job if he knew I was only 13, so I told him I was 17. He hired me on the spot for $40 a week in cash. I was thrilled. It was my first real job. Babysitting and tutoring and doing other kids' homework and mowing lawns and redeeming bottles and selling scrap metal didn't count. $40 a week was serious money. I liked the work. People buying jewelry were always happy. And even though Welch was a poor town, Becker's Jewel Box had plenty of customers. Older miners buying their wives a mother's pin, a brooch with a birthstone for each of her children. Teenage couples shopping for engagement rings, the girl giggling with excitement, the boy acting proud and manly. During the slow spells, Mr. Becker and I watched the Watergate hearings on a little black and white TV. Mr. Becker was captivated by John Dean's wife, Maureen, who sat behind her husband while he was testifying and wore elegant clothes and pulled her blonde hair back in a tight bun. "Hot damn, that's one classy broad," Mr. Becker would say. Sometimes after watching Maureen Dean, Mr. Becker got so randy that he came behind me while I was cleaning the display case and rubbed up against my backside. I'd pull his hands off and walk away without saying a word, and that horn dog would return to the television as if nothing had happened. When Mr. Becker went across the street to the Mountaineer Diner for lunch, he always took the key to the display case that held the diamond rings. If customers came in wanting to look at the rings, I had to run across the street to get him. Once he forgot to take the key, and when he returned, he made a big point of counting the rings in front of me. It was his way of letting me know he didn't trust me in the slightest. One day, after Mr. Becker had come back from lunch and ostentatiously checked the display cases, I was so furious that I looked around to see if there was anything in the entire darn store worth stealing. Necklaces, brooches, banjos, none of them did anything for me. And then the watch display caught my eye. I had always wanted a watch. Unlike diamonds, watches were practical. They were for people on the run, people with appointments to keep and schedules to meet. That was the kind of person I wanted to be. Dozens of watches ticked away in the counter behind the cash register. There was one in particular that made me ache. It had four different colored bands, black, brown, blue, and white, so you could change your watch band to match your outfit. It had a price tag of $29.95, $10 short of a week's salary. But if I wanted, it could be mine in an instant, and for free. The more I thought about that watch, the more it called to me. One day, the woman who worked at the store Mr. Becker owned and wore stopped by. Mr. Becker wanted her to give me some beauty tips. While she was showing me her different makeup applicators, the woman, who had stiff platinum hair and eyelashes tarred in mascara, told me I must be earning a truckload in commissions. When I asked her what she meant, she said that in addition to her $40 a week salary, she made 10% on every sale. Her commissions were sometimes double her salary. "Hell, welfare'll get you more than 40 bucks a week," she said. "If you're not getting commissions, Becker's stiffen you." When I asked Mr. Becker about commissions, he said they were for salespeople, and I was just an assistant. The next day, when Mr. Becker went off to the Mountaineer, I opened the display case and took out the four-band watch. I slipped it into my handbag and rearranged the remaining watches to cover the gap. I made plenty of sales on my own when Mr. Becker was busy. Since he hadn't paid me any commissions, I was only taking what I was owed. When Mr. Becker came back from lunch, he studied the diamond ring display like he always did, but he didn't even glance at the watches. Walking home that evening with a watch hidden in my purse, I felt light and giddy. After dinner, I climbed into my bunk bed where no one could see me and tried on the watch with each of the bands, gesturing the way I figured rich people did. Wearing the watch to work was out of the question, of course. I also realized that I could run into Mr. Becker in town at any time. So I decided that until school started, I'd put the watch on only at home.